From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. 16-year-old Gracie Cunningham had questions about math. Her questions weren't about her homework. They were actually far more fundamental than that. Gracie wanted to know what math really is. So she took to TikTok for answers.
I was just doing my makeup for work, and I just wanted to tell you guys about how I don't think math is real. And I know that, like, it's real because we all, like, learn it in school or whatever, but who came up with this concept? And you're like, Pythagoras. But how? How did he come up with this? He was living in, like, the, I don't know, whenever he was living, but it was not now, where you can, like, have technology and stuff, you know? Like, he didn't even have plumbing.
Cue the internet trolls. In their customary spasm of immaturity, they branded Gracie Math Girl, and the mockery piled on. So Gracie made a follow-up in which she says she tried to sound smart.
My first question is, how did people know what they were looking for when they started theorizing about formulas? Because I wouldn't know what to look for if I'm making up math. Question number two, once they did find these formulas, how did they know that they were right? Because how? Number three, why is everyone being really mean to me on Twitter?
Gracie, my answer to that is because Twitter is a terrible place. Now, here's the thing. There are people out there who have real answers to Gracie's questions because they're real mathematicians. And one of them joins us now, Eugenia Cheng. She's a mathematician, a concert pianist, an author, and her latest book is X Plus Y, A Mathematician's Manifesto for Rethinking Gender. And we have an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. Eugenia, welcome to On Point.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, you know, I'm looking at your website, Eugenia, and there's a beautiful multi-page document where you list all of Gracie's questions and you give her thoughtful, mathematically based answers. And I'm curious to hear what one of your answers are. Gracie had asked, how did people know what they were looking for when they started theorizing about formulas? And this is actually one of the, I think, the fundamental questions of how do mathematical proofs get developed. So how did you answer Gracie's question?
Well, the first thing was to empathize with Gracie, because whenever we're teaching math or talking to anyone, it's so important to understand where that person is coming from. And I fully sympathize with her curiosity, her questions, and her barely veiled frustration, honestly, especially in the first video, because these are really important questions and they're rarely addressed in standard math education. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's very understandable that she would feel frustrated and want to know those answers.
Well, I have can I just jump in here? Because she mentioned, mm-hmm. Gracie mentioned Pythagoras, for example, mm-hmm. right? And I visited the Greek island where Pythagoras lived once, and there's a mm-hmm. there's actually a statue to him. And it's a statue of Pythagoras standing with his hand straight up in the air, and there's an angle coming down from his finger. I mean, it's a rendering of A squared plus B squared equals C squared, right? And mm-hmm. I actually, at that moment, I thought, what a remarkable discovery. I had the same question Gracie did. Where do mathematicians even begin with that kind of inquiry?
Right. And the thing is that when math is presented as a finished fact, something that is a bunch of rules that you're supposed to learn, it can appear that it has just descended out of nowhere, like maybe an alien spaceship dropped it on top of your head. And that is very baffling. Whereas for me, math comes from wanting to understand things more efficiently. And I quite often say this, that it comes from being lazy. That if you see the same thing happening over and over again, you don't want to keep redoing it. You want some way to do it one time and then never have to think about it again. And I liken it to something like inventing the dishwasher, where I like to imagine, and I don't know quite how the dishwasher was invented, but I like to imagine that someone just got really fed up with washing dishes and thought, okay, I'm going to make a machine that will do this for me so that I can use my human brain to do something more interesting. And that's, for me, the starting point of mathematics and of a formula. It's to say something keeps happening over and over again, and I don't want to have to keep doing it over and over again because that's not interesting. So I'm going to invest the time to make some theory that will do many things for me so that I can move on to something else. And that's where it comes from.
You can't. We're not in the same place, Eugenia. So you can't see me smile right now, but I really am smiling because the thought that like these great discoveries of mathematics, these proofs which help us fully, you know, fundamentally understand the world are acts of intellectual laziness. Like, I just, it's a different way of thinking about math than I ever had. But what you're saying here, though, and we'll get to how gender works its way into all of this, is that fundamentally, what is it that mathematics helps us do? Because I think that's one of the things that Gracie was trying to get to in her line of inquiry.
Right. And one of the reasons it's such a thorny question is because I think that deep down, it does the opposite of what many people feel that it does in math classes. Because unfortunately, so many people's experience of math class is that it's very pointless and painful, and that the questions are there to do nothing but inflict pain on poor young people. And I'd just like to say right up front that I'm not blaming the teachers for this at all, but because the teachers are constrained by the ridiculous standards imposed on them by completely pointless, in my opinion, standardized tests. And when they're judged by how well their own students do in the standardized tests, then of course they have to try and just get people to do better in standardized tests. So I'd just like to say I'm definitely not blaming teachers. However, math is really there to help us. It's there to help us understand things and to help us use our brains more efficiently and more powerfully, because the world around us is a very complicated place and our poor little brains are finite. And so there are basically two ways that we can understand the world better. We can just willfully ignore some aspects of it. And unfortunately, that's what many people do. But I understand why they do it, because we're trying to simplify the world to understand it. But I think that a better way to do it is to make connections between different parts of the world so we can spot similarities between different situations and say, oh, actually, this situation and this other situation have something in common. And therefore, we can take that thing that's in common and study that by itself, therefore understanding both of those situations at the same time. Mm-hmm. And that's what math does.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen in my own family some math-loving folks when they, you know, there's almost that that beatific smile that graces their face when they see sort of a new pattern, right? Because that's the thing, that math helps us understand these patterns as they move through the world. And it's almost like a revelation is the word I keep coming up with. So that's the beauty.
Yeah.
That's the beauty
yeah.
of mathematics. But there's yeah. something not so beautiful here in what in terms of how the internet responded to Gracie's questions, okay, right? Because she asked there, she asked, why are people being so mean to me? And yeah. this is what we really want to talk with you about, because you are a woman in mathematics. So Gracie asked that question, first of all, like, how did that strike you?
It really resonated with me. And I was very touched by the fact that she asked it with such good humor. And she was still smiling. And I hope she's all right, because the amount of attention she's received is far beyond what she was expecting. And she didn't ask for that attention. Now, when some of us put ourselves in the public eye deliberately. And when I first decided to put myself in the public eye, it was a very big decision, because I knew that people were going to be horrible to me, unfortunately. And I decided to take that on, because I decided that I could do something helpful for the world by putting myself there. And I just decided to accept that negative things were going to happen. And so when Gracie said that, I wanted to try and say something positive to help outweigh all the negative things that were happening, and also to back her up and to try and explain my point of view on why people are mean, especially to women and younger women, mm-hmm. and especially in subjects that are perceived as being the male domain.
Yeah. You know, I have to say, Gracie was 16 when she put those questions out on the internet, and she was right at the age where girls especially get derailed from their love of mathematics, I'll say. You know, the mm-hmm. like preteen and teenage, the teenage years are really hard for girls who love science and math. So can mm-hmm. you just We'll talk about your book in a second, but I'd love to actually just learn from you and your history. I mean, did you go through that troubling period? Obviously, it didn't derail you because you are a renowned mathematician.
I was very lucky because I actually went to an all-girls school. Uh-huh. And I had a scholarship there, and I was very fortunate because it meant I was completely protected from those kinds of stereotypes in those crucial teenage years. I also had amazing support from my parents, who have somewhat gender reverse roles relative to stereotypes, because it's my mother who's really mathematical. And so I never thought there was any reason I couldn't do it. In fact, my parents and my education brought me up to truly believe that I could do anything that men could do, and that there was really no question about it. But I understand that many girls, possibly even most girls, don't grow up with that kind of baseline of support. And in fact, they have people belittling them all through their teenage years, possibly in school. And many people, in fact, have written to me. I've been inundated with messages from adults who've read my responses to Gracie. And they tell me that they're sitting there in tears, mm-hmm. because it's the first time that they have felt that anyone has understood their desire to have those questions answered, and that they too, when they were teenagers, wanted to ask those questions. And people made them feel dumb for wanting to know. And this is the first time that they have felt like they weren't dumb for wanting to know. And so I think it's an unfortunately very widespread experience that people are curious and want to ask those questions. And it's often, not always, and we'll come to that, but often it's female students. And then someone else, often not, but not always, a male student who feels very confident about his math abilities, tells them that those are really dumb questions, because of course these formulae are really obvious. And then they go away, the girls, and feel like they're not good at math and that they should go and do something else.
Yeah. You know, I mean, those formulas may be obvious now, but they were not 2,000 years ago. And that's the fundamental thing, right? That mathematical discoveries happen. And Eugenia, when we come back from the break, that's what I want to pick up on. Why you decided to use the very tenets of mathematics to question concepts of gender. So stand by here for just a moment. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today we are talking with Eugenia Cheng. She is a mathematician, an educator, a concert pianist, and an author. She's a scientist in residence at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago, author of many books, including How to Bake a Pie, P.I., An Edible Exploration of the Mathematics, The Art of Logic in an Illogical World. And her latest book is X Plus Y, A Mathematician's Manifesto for Rethinking Gender. Okay, so Eugenia, let me start with a basic question. What is it that mathematics allows us to do in rethinking gender that other sciences or social sciences cannot do?
I might not dare to say that mathematics can inherently do something that other sciences can't do, but there's something that I found that it helped me do that I hadn't seen done. And it's possible that many people could have come at this conclusion from other directions. So far be it from me to say that other subjects would not have been able to do it. But what I did was I used the way of thinking of my research field, which is category theory. That's a very abstract part of mathematics, and it might seem highly implausible that some abstract part of mathematics could help us with something as embedded in life as gender and gender assumptions in the world around us. But mathematics is about thinking clearly through situations and understanding what's at their core, making them really work. And it's about spotting similarities between different situations and then making a theory that can help us understand all of those situations at the same time. And all of that is highly relevant to really anything that we think about, including gender.
So category theory, then. I'll be perfectly honest, not familiar with it at all. What is it?
Well, it's a relatively new branch of mathematics, and I like to call it the mathematics of mathematics. So where mathematics finds similarities between different aspects of, say, science to make a theory of how science works, category theory finds similarities between different aspects of mathematics to find theories about how mathematics works. But because mathematics is about science, which is about life, I realized that the way of thinking of category theory is really broadly applicable. And this is something that's often missed about mathematics. People talk about how useful it is and the applications and how we can calculate answers and produce answers to things. But for me, it's about a way of thinking. And so even if the theory itself doesn't provide an answer, the discipline of how to think clearly is a highly, highly applicable and transferable skill. And the part of category theory that is really fundamental to me is the part that says that instead of thinking about intrinsic characteristics of things, we can gain a lot of insight by thinking about relationships, how things relate to each other, rather than what their intrinsic characteristics are. And that is the starting point for how I started rethinking gender.
Okay, so we'll get to the how you applied that to gender in just a second, but I mean, I know this is radio, but let's do it anyway. Can you give me sort of a mathematical example of category theory at work?
Yes. So, for example, if we just think about numbers, which are a fundamental object in mathematics, they're not all of mathematics. There's a myth that math is all about numbers, and that's not right. Numbers are a starting point, but let's take it as an example. We could think of trying to define the number two. What is the number two? And we can try and think of it as something intrinsic about two-ness. But if we think of it as a relationship instead, it just is what you get when you add one and one. Mm-hmm. And so some people say, why does one add one equal two? Well, in a way, if we characterize two as the thing that we get from one and one, then we're thinking about its relationship to the number one. And then we think about its relationship to the number three. And then that's what really matters, is how they relate to each other. So it doesn't matter that we call them one, two, and three. It doesn't matter if we paint them red and blue. And indeed, it doesn't matter if we speak different languages and say them in different languages with different words. What matters is how those things relate to each other rather than what they're actually like in themselves.
So that's fascinating, because the relationships, though, the fundamentalness of the relationship between the concept of two to three or two to one, regardless of language, regardless of culture, regardless of who the mathematician or person is that's looking at what two-ness means, the fundamental should be the same?
Yes. And the thing that's important is the relationships, not how it is that we define two itself.
Right. But I guess what I'm saying is that whoever is looking at what those relationships are, those relationships should be the same. We just might call them different things.
Right. Okay. Yes, exactly.
Okay, good. So then apply that. Then take us through the beginning of how that applies to how you began to rethink gender.
Well, I realize that the same applies to people, and that we can often understand a lot about people by watching how they relate to other people, and that it doesn't really matter what they look like or what kind of person they are or what identity they have. What matters in human interaction is fundamentally how we treat each other, whether someone is kind to someone else or not, or whether they are patronizing and derogatory like some people on Twitter. And that is a separate issue to people's identity. Now, I'm not saying that people's identity is unimportant, because identity is important in how we experience the world. And so women and people of color and trans people and LGBTQ people experience bad things from people around them, specifically because of their identity. But when we're thinking about, say, whether someone is good at mathematics, then we do better just to think about how they relate to mathematics and how they think, rather than necessarily trying to relate that to some intrinsic characteristic about them, like their gender.
So tell me more about that. I guess maybe I'm having a little hard time following, and forgive me, but is it that the reframing that you're doing here is considering gender as a characteristic that's relational to others versus intrinsic? Or do I have that wrong?
Well, we need to be a little bit careful here because, okay, of course, gender is a social construct. And so in a way, gender is just about how we interact with society. But what I'm saying is that gender is separate from the actual the characteristics that we have when we behave. And this is about how we interact with other people. So for example, if we associate behavior with gender, then we're claiming that behavior is determined by gender somehow. And then we're not allowing for people to behave in different ways, regardless of what gender they have. And we're making assumptions that gender is tied to behavior, which it needn't be, because men and women can behave in all sorts of ways. And so the point here is that we have used words like masculine and feminine to describe behavior. And that doesn't really make any sense, because I am a female person, so everything I do is feminine, really, because I'm a female person. And so I don't think we should use the word feminine to describe behavior. I think we should just describe behavior separately from gender.
Okay, so you're talking about the importance of contextualizing, right? And do I have that right?
Yes. Okay. Yes. Well, and I think that one of the things that really helped me focus on this was when I switched from teaching. I used to be a kind of normal math professor teaching math majors in normal research universities, and it was very male dominated. And then I switched, and now I teach art students at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. It's a very different environment, and it's very female dominated. And I started thinking about how that affects the relationships between us in the classroom. Because a previous experience I had was that I was a research fellow in a female college in Cambridge. And it was an all-women's college, but it didn't seem to make any difference to the feeling of the environment. It was just as kind of competitive and aggressive as I had found the rest of academia. And so I realized that it's not just about being surrounded by women. It's about the character types of people, and that men can have different character types as well. And I think that society has been encouraging people to have particular kinds of character types and rewarding that kind of individualistic, competitive, aggressive, ambitious, over self-confident behavior. And that's the kind of behavior that we reward. So everyone tries to be as much like that as possible in order to succeed. And however, I think that's counterproductive, because I don't think that those types of behaviors are actually helpful for society.
Mm. And we tend to reward those types of behavior when they're exhibited by men. And I would say women still take considerable risk in exhibiting
that type of behavior. I do agree. I think that we are hypocritical, because we often tell women they need to be more like that in order to be successful. And then we promptly criticize them when they are like that, saying that they are loud or angry or aggressive. Or if we say that a woman is behaving in a masculine way, that sounds like there's inherently something contradictory going on. And that's why I wanted to introduce some new terminology to help us escape that one-dimensional gendered thinking, where either women are supposed to become more like men to be successful, or we say, actually, women are better than men, so men should become more like women. Or then some people say that there's a war on men, and that then this kind of gives rise to toxic masculinity, where men play up to traditional stereotypical male behavior because they think they're being attacked. And all of this is unhelpful, obstructive, and contributes further to the divisiveness of contemporary dialogue.
Mm-hmm. So about that new language or new terminology, there are a couple of other terms in your book that stand out. Ingressive versus, or maybe versus isn't the right word, but ingressive and congressive behaviors. Yes. Now, first of all, mm-hmm. how do those terms apply within mathematics to begin with?
Well, ingressive is to signify going into things and being more individualistic. And congressive is to signify bringing things together and taking into account of context and making connections between things. And this can be applied to people, people's behavior. And I'm really glad that you said versus isn't the right word, because they're not in opposition to each other. It's just ways of describing things. And it can be applied at all levels. So it can be applied to people, it can be applied to society, structures, family, interactions, and even apply to mathematics itself and the way we present mathematics. And I think that typical math education presents math in an ingressive way, because it presents it as facts that we have to learn. It's very much about authority. An authority figure, a teacher, tells you what you're supposed to do, and then you're supposed to obey those rules. And then we have tests and exams, which are also very ingressive. It's not a collaborative affair. It's about speed. It's about ranking people. And it's fundamentally about filtering people out, saying who is good enough and who isn't good enough. And I consider those to be ingressive characteristics that therefore put off congressive people who are more interested in connections, relationships, exploration, and something that's less black and white than right answers.
Mm. Now, Eugenia, about me correcting myself in the middle of a sentence. Frequent listeners to this show will be familiar with that behavior, because I'm just a relentless self-editor, even in real time here. But part of that is that I think, in fact, perhaps let's apply this to this conversation, that we should always be testing our own theories, whether it's a question that I'm asking or an answer that I'm receiving. So part I would think that, if I can just stretch this analogy a little bit, constructing a new mathematical proof, part of what you have to show is what it is not. So I'm curious about this approach that you're using, applying category theory to how we think about gender. I'm wondering what do you think that it's revealing that other theories or ways of thinking about gender haven't already revealed?
What it has revealed to me is that the underlying assumptions we've made about who will be good at math aren't right. And I think many research mathematicians know this deep down, because we basically all know that exams are a terrible way of predicting future research success, because they test something else entirely. In fact, exams don't test anything at all except your ability to do that particular exam on that particular day. And it's not a very transferable skill in any way. Whereas research is about many things. It's about curiosity. It's about thinking. It's about, as you say, testing and correcting your own theory. And it's really importantly about self-doubt. And that's where this idea that confidence is good, well, it's not a very good idea, because confidence means that people think things are obvious. And that comes back to the responses to Paul Gracie's questions, where people said, oh, you're so dumb, these things are so obvious. If you think things are obvious, then it usually in math means you're missing something, because nothing is really obvious. And the reason that math grows all the time is because mathematicians are never quite satisfied with any answers to anything. And so we probe further and further to get deeper and deeper answers, because we're not ever quite satisfied with what we've done. And so in a way, I think that self-doubt is possibly a more important attribute for doing mathematics than self-confidence. And you might say, yes, a balance is important. So it's important not to be consumed by your self-doubt, but that is where the environment can come in to help us, and that the current environment is not very supportive. So many people have discovered that if they ask those searching questions, they get told they're stupid. Whereas if we supported people more and encouraged them, then they wouldn't have to have self-confidence, because we would give them confidence. And in a supportive environment, I think that self-confidence is really much less important. And then we can support the people who have good self-doubt, who have the potential, I think, to be better mathematicians.
Huh. And so has this way of looking at the world, has it changed like your day-to-day practice?
Yes, it has. And this all started because I was trying to understand my own experience of math and also help more people, because it makes me so sad that so many people are traumatized by math and have math phobia, which often then results in people saying they hate math. And I love math, so it makes me sad to see it misunderstood and hated by people. And I think that it really is misunderstood. And so I think really hard about why people are put off. And I think it's because they have not been sufficiently supported to ask the questions they want to ask, explore in the ways they want to explore, and see the creativity and the point of mathematics, mm-hmm. rather than just being told they're wrong because they didn't get this particular answer right, or somebody else did it faster, and someone is competing against them to show how clever they are.
Yeah.
And so with my art students, I've been thinking so hard about how to create a congressive educational environment.
Eugenia, hold on for just a second. We just have to take a quick break here, and people are hearing a little bit of piano in the background. That's you playing Schubert. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to be talking about unemployment. It's been half a year now since the pandemic triggered historic layoffs in this country, and millions of Americans have not yet received their unemployment benefits. So if that's you and you've tried to get those benefits, we want to hear your story. Call us at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. That's for tomorrow's show. Today, we are speaking with Eugenia Cheng. She is author of X Plus Y, A Mathematician's Manifesto for Rethinking Gender. We have an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. Eugenia is a mathematician, an educator, a concert pianist. You heard her play a little bit of Schubert at the end of the last segment. She's also a scientist in residence at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. And Eugenia, before the break, I'm sorry that I had to interrupt you there, but you were talking about how your rethinking of gender or applying mathematical concepts to how we think about gender, how that's changed how you work with your students at the Art Institute?
Yes. It gives me a way to frame how I think about what I'm going to teach and how I teach it. Because when we're stuck thinking about gender, then we get stuck saying silly things like, oh, I need a classroom activity that will appeal to girls. And that sounds really stupid. And it is stupid. Because who knows what's going to appeal to girls and what's going to appeal to boys? And that's where in normal life, when we say things like, oh, well, usually women do this and men do that, then someone gets offended. And then we have to qualify it by saying, oh, but not all women and not all men. And so I had a previous experience where I would find that at the beginning of a semester, I would have students in my office crying because they felt like they were just not good enough and that they should drop out. And it was typically female students. And then I have to say, but not all women and not all men. Whereas male students, and then I have to say, but not all men, male students often thought they were doing fantastically when actually they were doing terribly. And so now I can say, well, ingressive students overestimate their own abilities and congressive students underestimate their abilities. And so I need classroom activities that help congressive students believe that they can do something and understand, find what their abilities are and make use of those abilities in the exploration of mathematics.
And this approach ideally would be something that would help every student, regardless of who they are or what gender they are.
Exactly. It helps male students, female students, and non-binary students as well, who were so erased by this gender binary that we go on about. And I think it would help a lot at earlier stages of education. And my art students often say to me, oh, I wish that math had been presented more like this in school. I might not have been so put off. Because math in sort of kindergarten and first grade is much more congressive. It's about play and exploration. We give children objects to mess around with and explore and to find out the relationships between numbers for themselves. They take some little blocks or something, and then they take some more, and then they see how many there are, and then maybe we start getting them to arrange them in patterns and grids to understand how numbers interact with each other. And then at some point it becomes very ingressive, and it turns into answer this question. No, you got it wrong. How many points did you score on this test? You have this time limited test. How many questions can you do? Oh, well, this person did better than you. Oh, well, these are the good people who are good at math. These are the people who are bad at math. And then some kids will want to ask questions like, but why? Why is 1 add 1 2? Why does 2 times 3 equal 3 times 2? Whereas some other kids will be going, oh, that's really obvious. I'm really good at math. And then these students who have these more expansive questions will be more drawn to the more obviously congressive subjects like art and like writing, where there aren't so much right and wrong answers, but that where you can create things for yourself and create worlds and characters and relationships. And that makes me sad, because in research math, we create worlds and characters and relationships. And somehow you have to wait from the age of 6 through years and years and years of tests and exams before you start doing a PhD and get to do that kind of math again.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, the thing that school kids forget because they're not taught it, is that there's a spectacular creativity in mathematics. Yeah, so you're exactly right. There's a point in time where it becomes sort of tests, measurements, and rules. So give me what an example of what, say, geometry education would be that wasn't just to memorize how we get pi.
Well, one thing I do with my students is that I talk about the Platonic solids, but I don't tell them what the Platonic solids are. We just sit down and talk about symmetry. Symmetry is about relationships, really, between objects and themselves. So if you flip an object over and it still looks the same, then it's got some kind of symmetry. If you turn it around and it looks the same, it's got some kind of symmetry. And so we just explore what shapes we can fit together. So we take two-dimensional shapes and cut them out. And I just let them explore, sticking them together and seeing what kind of three-dimensional shapes they can make. And I say that the Platonic solids are the really, really maximally symmetrical ones. And then everyone sits down and builds things. And some people build Platonic solids. And some people build things that are almost Platonic solids but don't quite have all the symmetry. And some people will build a dinosaur, because this is art school. And, you know, if they build a dinosaur, they've still learnt something. Because what they discover is that pentagons, that's shapes with 5 sides, are a terrible shape to use to try and build a dinosaur. It doesn't work at all. Whereas triangles are a great shape to use. You can build practically anything with triangles. And that's actually a profound mathematical concept that gets used in all levels of research mathematics, where we use triangulations, as they're called, to break down really complicated shapes into triangles to understand them via these building blocks.
So I can't resist, Eugenia. I just can't resist. Why are triangles so cool, so powerful?
Oh, that's a really great question. And so one of the reasons that they're cool is that they're the only, it's the only number of sides where the lengths of the sides fully determines what shape you're going to get. Because once you have 4 or more sides, you can fix the lengths of the sides, but the shape might still be able to take different forms. So for example, if you take 4 pieces of wood and stick them together, you could make a square, but you could make a diamond shape, like a rhombus. And this is something that people know if they do woodwork and build things, that if you want to make a rigid structure, you put diagonals into things to, like, on a table, when you attach a table to a tabletop, you might put a diagonal thing in to stabilize it, because that triangle is going to make it rigid. And that is one of the reasons, that's one of the many reasons, that triangles are sort of different from other shapes.
You know, actually, funnily enough, I hadn't thought about that, that any number of sides beyond three, you suddenly get a multiplicity of possible shapes, like all sorts of polygons. But three is always going to be a triangle. Wow. I mean, it's funny, like my educational background is in engineering. So I was like viewed a triangle as just like the strong shape, right? Mm-hmm. But why it's strong is not something I probably thought about enough. Now, so what you're really getting at here is an entirely different model of education writ large, not just mathematical education, but education writ large. And this is a huge, giant field of debate and inquiry and
yes,
and questioning here. But I am curious about, do you look to see other places, maybe other countries, where they are using more ingressive models of education, as you would call it?
What, more congressive models?
Oh, sorry, congressive.
Yes, and so one of the examples I talk about is the example of Finland, which is quite famous among education circles, but it's also been, people have been kind of trying to debunk it. But what happened was that Finland surprised the world by doing really well the first time there was an international evaluation of teenagers' achievements in various aspects of education. And Finland had turned out to have a really congressive kind of education, and they were never aiming to have high standards. What they were aiming for was equity and inclusion. And so they have an amazing system where they do not have any private schools. So everyone has supposedly very equal access to the same kinds of education. And the emphasis is on community and collaboration. It's not on achievement. And I think more broadly, this is really important for the current era, because in previous eras, it was important to just get information during education because we didn't have good access to information. And so just knowing stuff was important. But now we have access to too much information. The issue has gone entirely the other way. We have too much information. And what's way more important than getting knowledge is learning how to discern what counts as good information and what doesn't count as good information. And that is what is sorely lacking in the world at the moment, because things go viral, regardless of whether or not they're true. People believe conspiracy theories without having a framework to back them up. And every academic discipline comes with a way of deciding what counts as good information. And that's why Gracie's question was so pertinent, the one about how do we know it's right? Mm-hmm. Because for me, what's much more important in education is how to decide if things are right, not to be able to give the right answer, but to be able to construct an argument and a framework for justifying an answer. And that's a much more congressive thing than just being able to spew out facts that someone has transplanted into your brain.
So, but in being able to construct an argument to support the answer, does that not leave open still the possibility that people are going to disagree over what is right? And I always thought, this is a simplistic thought, but I always thought that one of the great things about mathematics is that It gives us a set of tools to really be able to say right, wrong, yes, no, the equation balances or it doesn't.
Well, in higher mathematics, it's more about context. So rather than saying this is right and this is wrong, we say here is a sense in which this is right, because maybe in a different context, this other thing is right. And so as a very basic example that also caused a huge storm on the internet recently, you might think that 2 + 2 just does equal 4. But then a whole load of mathematicians popped up and said, oh, well, actually, here is a context in which 2 + 2 equals something else. And 2 + 2 can equal 5. 2 + 2 can equal 0. In other contexts, 2 + 2 can equal 3. And many people, I think the same kinds of people who told Gracie she's dumb, got really upset about this because they so want to believe that math is a thing that they're good at, that has clear right answers, that delineates them as a cleverer person than other people. And so to see people actually say things that maybe they found difficult to understand was a threat to their self-esteem, and so they got really upset about it. But actually, higher level math is about finding different contexts in which different things are true, because the world around us has many different contexts, and different things can be true depending on how you look at them. And so for me, math is really about having a flexible way of thinking so that you can see different points of view. And this is completely opposite to how it's usually presented in education and how most non-mathematicians view it as a subject.
I will fully admit that my mathematical education ended with calculus applications to engineering problems, so not the higher level math that you're talking about. But now, Eugenia, we have just a couple of minutes left, and I want to just explore a little bit more about examples of congressive behaviors in the world around us, and specifically, perhaps, let's say, in leadership through this pandemic, right? Because I think some people have pointed out that there are several countries out there who have done better than others. And they like to point out that many of those countries have female leaders. Do you think that's significant or not?
I think it could well be significant. And we need to be careful because it's not the it's not the sheer fact of their biology of being female that is the issue. I think that I'm not saying we should ignore gender. We definitely shouldn't be gender blind. And there is possibly something in the fact that a country that is even able to elect a female leader, unlike this country, a country that is able to may be just a different kind of country already, the fact that they can even do that. But aside from that, it's more about the style of leadership rather than the specific gender of the person. And so maybe it's to do with the fact that they were not overconfident. They did not simply bluster about the fact that we could deal with this, that they did seek the help of experts and listen to experts in cases where they weren't experts themselves. Of course, in some of the countries, the leaders turned out to be experts. But taking on board those opinions rather than assuming that you're right yourself is important. And also not taking enormous risks with human life. Maybe that's also a congressive aspect. And I think that risk-taking is another one of those behaviors that's often associated with men that women are often told they need to do in order to be more successful. Oh, you have to take risks to be successful. And I disagree with that because I don't take risks. I'm absolutely not a risk taker. And I do believe I'm successful. Instead of taking risks, I build safety nets to mitigate for those risks, which I think is a much more sensible way of behaving. And I think that taking a risk with human life is a more ingressive behavior. You think that we're going to be able to deal with this because we're a great country. That's a kind of ingressive approach. Whereas being safer and protecting people is a more congressive approach. And maybe that is what helped some countries to do better. Of course, further research is needed. But having this terminology at all helps me to think more clearly about it rather than getting stuck in saying, well, it's because they were women.
Yeah. Well, we've just got 1 minute left, Eugenia, and I'm thinking about all the people listening there, particularly the girls listening right now who hopefully are feeling quite inspired by you and your path and the work that you're doing. I was just wondering, we've got 30 seconds now. What advice would you have for them if they're in that moment in life where maybe they're getting pushback for their fundamental questions about math?
I would say, believe that the people who think they're brilliant aren't necessarily more brilliant than you. And actually, the greatest mathematicians I know, we all think we're really stupid.
Well, Eugenia Cheng is author of X Plus Y, A Mathematician's Manifesto for Rethinking Gender. We have an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. Eugenia is a mathematician, an educator, a concert pianist, and scientist in residence at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. Eugenia, thank you so very much for joining us today.
Thank you. It was a great pleasure.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston and your NPR station. From Loomis Sayles, an investment partner working to navigate challenging financial markets around the globe, and offering investment strategies to clients worldwide since 1926. Learn more at LoomisSales.com. And LifeLock, reminding consumers there was a victim of identity theft every 3 seconds in 2019. Learn more at LifeLock.com/NPR.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Coming up on the next On Point, 6 months after the pandemic plunged a historic number of Americans into unemployment, millions still haven't received their unemployment benefits. We'll take a look at why. Plus, we'll have lessons in leadership from the life of President Dwight Eisenhower. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.